Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 26th. I'm Ray Graff. On today's program, well, we call it the Copyright Forum. And joining us today, Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood. They're here to answer your questions about protecting your writing, your music, your art. If you have a question about copyright law or what's in the public domain, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email your questions about intellectual property to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Paul, Bill, your copyright calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today's show is the Copyright Forum. It's been a couple of months since we've done one. To answer your questions, we have two guests on the line today. Paul Rapp is an intellectual property lawyer and writer. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, and businesses involved in the creative economy. He lectures widely on intellectual property issues. Bill Westwood is one of the country's leading medical illustrators and a professional member and past president of the Association of Medical Illustrators. You got a question about intellectual property? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And I should mention that usually this is a trio of guests on this Copyright Forum. Polly Law is usually the third person here, or the first person. Or the second person. Really, it doesn't matter. But the point is, it's very tough, almost impossible to do a call-in show where we take calls from listeners and have more than two guests, because then the third guest would have to be on the bank of phones that our callers are on, and every time I hung up on a caller, I would hang up on the guest. So Polly drew the short straw, but she is well and will be back with us soon. Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
How you guys doing?
Good.
It's been, since February, since we've done this show. And, you know, since then, I've been watching Paul Rapp's posts on social media. Zeppelin finally off the hook on Stairway to Heaven. And it also ties in with a Katy Perry copyright suit. So, Paul, fill us in on that.
Well, they finally, as far as Led Zeppelin goes, got the law right that, you know, what they were being sued over was a chord progression, and those aren't protectable. Yeah. by copyright law. For music, it's lyrics and melody. And so they finally, you know, after years of litigation, apparently got that right, unless it goes to the Supreme Court, and I'm not aware. Katy Perry, I think hers was just like a very short phrase that she incorporated in her song, and they got that right too. I mean, it's been 6-7 years, and copyright law in the courts has been in an upheaval ever since the Blurred Lines case, where they, you know, basically allowed a jury to decide that a groove of a song was protectable, which is insane. You know, I mean, if a groove was protectable, Bo Diddley would be richer than Jeff Bezos, you know?
All right, that's very good. Well, Katy Perry, and I'm quoting here from Rolling Stone magazine, she won her appeal in the dispute over the 2013 hit Dark Horse. And at issue here, according to Rolling Stone, was an 8-note musical phrase known as an ostinato from the song Joyful Noise. That's from the Christian rapper Flame. And Flame, whose real name is Marcus Gray, said, okay, you lifted that. But the court said, you know what? It's undisputed that there are elements that are the same, but there's nothing particularly unique or rare about this combination. Neither of you are entitled to the copyright on it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved in cases on both sides of the fence, you know, where, you know, there's an obvious similarity. And then, you know, somebody goes in and says, well, look, I mean, I had one where it was a fairly elaborate bass line that my client did on sort of a slow groove thing. And the other side came back and said, well, listen to the stylistics in 1974 and listen to this and listen to this and listen to this. And they were right. You know, I mean, it was a baseline that had become pretty much generic in the world of funk music. And, you know, my guy, you know, I had to call him and say, look, these guys are right. You know, you don't really have anything here. And, you know, and you know, and hopefully this trend of the courts getting it right will continue.
Hmm. Well, is that likely in truth?
I think so.
Bill is skeptical.
I have so little faith in the courts right now in terms of what they're coming down with in copyright law. It's a little discouraging for me as a visual artist. So. I hope Paul is right. I hope they continue getting things right. I do think they probably got it right in the two cases that were just mentioned. You know, but, you know, when it comes to visual art, some of the things that they're doing, some of the rules that the Copyright Office has, some of the rules that the court seems to be sporting, you know, are a little strange.
Bill Westwood is here. Paul Rapp is here. It's the Copyright Forum. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have a question. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And, fellas, we got an email here from Patricia. Patricia writes, I'm an architect, and it is sometimes difficult to explain to clients that architectural designs are copyrighted. Maybe I can't explain it well enough for clients. Can you offer a simple explanation?
For architectural design, it doesn't get a whole lot of protection, and that was proved in a local case a few years ago that I was involved in, where a local architect decided that one of his plans for a kind of suburban colonial house had been lifted by a couple of local draftspeople and builders, and went and sued basically everybody. And this had to go up on appeal to the Second Circuit, where the Second Circuit said, look, you know, this is a colonial house and there's not a whole lot unique here. I mean, with a colonial house, there's only a certain number of places where the windows can go and where the garage is going to go and where the kitchen is going to go and the stairways are going to go. And nobody can own those. You know, those are, you know, borderline generic elements. The more detailed an architectural plan is and the more unique it is, you know, the less it uses kind of basic tropes of architecture, the more protection it's going to get. They are protected. And if you take a very elaborate, blueprint, as opposed to just a kind of a standard basic, plan, you'll have some protection there. But it's important to understand the copyright doesn't protect effort or skill, or draftsmanship. It protects originality, you know, and that's why I say that architecture doesn't get all that much protection, because a lot of times, you know, it might be a skilled architect and got everything right, but didn't do a whole lot original in the planning.
Bill. Well, in response to the question, though, I think the way I would explain it to a client is that, whether a given design gets what level of, you know, protection should it ever go before a jury or a judge is one thing. But in terms of explaining why that copyright belongs to the architect, you simply refer them back to the U.S. copyright law and says that under, and I explain this to my clients in the same way, under U.S. copyright law, the person who basically puts pencil to paper or who puts something down in some give me the word, Paul, some a form.
Fixed form.
Survey that, said
that four. That person owns the copyright to that image, and whether or not that is copyrightable or totally protectable, again, you get into a bunch of other things. But technically, if I put pencil to paper and do a little scribble, and I want to put a copyright notice on it, it belongs to me. And then, you know, if it's reasonably original, then nobody else can copy that without my permission. So, you know, it's hard to explain, particularly I think if you're an architect, I think it's hard to explain to people who aren't familiar with copyright law. It's hard to explain to them why this particular drawing, or in my case, an illustration, might be protectable. I have clients say to me, well, look, I pay for it, I own it. And I know, I'm sorry, you know, you own certain aspects of it, or I might license certain aspects of it to you, but you don't own it, and you can't do with it as you please, other than if I sell you an original piece of art, then you can go and resell that if you want to. But if I retain the copyright, you can't go out and make posters of that and start selling them.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Bill Westwood is on the show today. So is Paul Rapp. It's the Copyright Forum. Our number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wabc.org. We'll be right back. Lovely. That's a Joe Pass and the orchestra. Paul Rapp is here. Bill Westwood is here. It's the Copyright Forum. And a couple of emails here, then we'll get right to the phones. 800-348-2551. Here's a standard email we get. You guys can dispatch this one fairly quickly. Anonymous writes, I'm wondering if using the U.S. mail to send your ideas, song, verse, or otherwise to yourself in a sealed envelope still has clout in the modern day of email.
It's never had clout, and it doesn't have clout now. You cannot do that, Paul. Take it.
Yeah, there has never been a case where an alleged infringer is on the witness stand and the lawyer, like, whips out the envelope with the, you know, with post-dated and says, I have an envelope here. You know, I mean, it just, no, it doesn't work. And why, you know, what you have to.
Why wouldn't it
what
work?
You have.
I mean, it worked in Miracle on 34th Street, Santa Claus, all those letters and everything, right?
This is known as a poor man's copyright, and it simply does not work. The copyright system and the copyright office do not recognize, nor do the courts, I guess, recognize that as providing any protection. The only way you can even take an infringement to court anyway is if the work is properly registered, and it has to be registered prior to the infringement for you to get statutory damages.
All right. This one is from somebody. Let's call her Karen because that's her name. I run a retail art studio and am developing art kits to sell. The kits include project information that is based on my 12 years of experience. Is there any way to protect the projects? Any other way an art kit as a whole could be protected as an original idea slash concept? And that's from Karen.
I don't think you can protect it as a concept, but you could protect it, couldn't you, Paul? Either by trademarking it and or copywriting individual parts of it that might be either instructional or illustrative.
Yes, you can look into trademarking your commercial name, the name of your business, and then the materials that you hand out, you can register the copyrights to those as literary or a combination of literary and graphic work. However, the ideas and the concepts, you know, somebody can go and paraphrase your idea and run with it, because ideas and concepts are not protectable under any theory.
All right, let's grab a phone call or two, and then we'll hit some more emails as well. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood join us on the Copyright Forum. Tom in Great Barrington. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Hello. You're on. Okay. Go ahead. It's up to you now. Hello. Okay. Tom, are you there? Okay. It's off to a flying start. I should have stayed home. Pat in Columbia County. Pat, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the show, guys. A couple comments. One about copywriting pictures on social media and the concern about placing things on Instagram and Facebook. There's been a lot of discussion recently about protection of pictures on Instagram. If you don't set it to private, if you set it to public, they can take the image embedded in the Instagram form and use it. And there was a case recently where a publisher, Ziff Davis and Mashable, took a photographer's photograph and used it after they offered her a lowball amount of money. She refused, and then they took the picture anyway. But like using an entire magazine cover, they took it from the embedded format in Instagram and used it without her permission. She sued for copyright infringement, and she lost. And the issue there, and another one attached to it, is we have strong copyright laws which are obeyed throughout any number of countries that pay attention to the conventions that created them. But the jurist that listens to each case is how this is finally determined. So you can have a law that says X and Y equals Z, but they don't. In the end, sometimes a judge will look at a Jeff Koons case where he infringed several times from photographer's work, and in one case say, absolutely, that's the case, he's guilty, and then another case which seems to be identical, he's off the hook. So the laws, despite their solid outlook, in fact, are really dependent upon whichever jurist is listening to that intellectual property case.
Either of you guys want to comment? Go ahead.
Well, that's pretty much true with every jury trial in the legal system, I think. The case that you mentioned, the Instagram case, as I recall, and I read it some weeks ago, had something to do with the fact that that by agreeing to the provisions provided by Instagram and how they could use the work, that the creator was not allowed to.
Because she didn't change the setting of Instagram to private.
Yeah,
she
what
left
I
it
advise,
as public.
What I advise illustrators, and I deal primarily with illustrators, is that under no circumstances should you post something on social media until you've registered the copyright. And
right.
The people do this all the time. They finish a nice new piece of work, and they get all excited, and they want everyone to see it, and they immediately post it. And I'm working on an article right now that describes the dangers and the rights that you're giving up. Most of these places like Instagram will require you to grant them some perpetual or other right to not only to use the work, but to modify the work if they so choose.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Paul, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, in terms of Instagram, I remember reading that and going, this is simply not going to hold up on appeal. The social media sites have these broad, these broad terms of service that appear to give them kind of unlimited power. But I think most of the time those are written because they realize the nature of social media is somebody's going to post something, then it's going to get shared and shared and shared again. And, you know, the original poster is not going to have much control just because of the architecture of the social media space. The original poster is not going to have a lot of control with what happens, and it just recognizes that. I think the court may have gotten it wrong, but we'll see what happens. You know, hopefully that will be appealed, and we'll be able to get some clarity on that decision. Because the idea of posting something on social media and losing your copyrights strikes me as fundamentally absurd. And you shouldn't have to take the kind of precautions that Bill is talking about in order to protect your rights. And in terms of Jeff Koons, there were two cases, but they were 15 or 20 years apart, I believe. And it really recognized how the doctrine of fair use, that you can use someone's copyrighted property to make a different kind of expression, and that it's okay. I think those two decisions really recognize the evolution of fair use and the opening up of fair use. I mean, the first one had to do with a postcard that Koons blatantly stole from, and the second one had to do with an advertisement in a woman's magazine with a pair of feet. And the judge, was looking at this painting, and Jeff Koons had blatantly stolen a woman's pair of feet from this woman's magazine layout. And the judge goes, "Well, why did you have to take that pair of feet, from the magazine? Why couldn't you just come up with your own pair of feet?"
Right.
And Jeff Koons said, "I'm an appropriation artist." Wow. And taking things from the real media, the actual media, is what gives my art validity, which sounds ridiculous. But when you think about appropriation art, that's absolutely, and I'm not a big fan of Jeff Koons for, aesthetic reasons. But in terms of doctrine and in terms of what appropriation art is or should be, that was the right answer. And, the court bought it. And it just, where I don't think 15 or 20 years before that, any court would have bought that argument, but it's
right.
It's a realization that that's what appropriation art is, and it's difficult, it's difficult conceptually. But I agree with Jeff Koons, and I agree with the court.
All right, let's go.
Well,
go ahead.
Koons and Prince have both taken this whole appropriation business, and they've stolen, from my perspective, they've stolen people's work. I just don't think that that the court's reasoning, certainly in the Prince case, justified. It simply wasn't truly transformative, and that's what the expansion of the fair use has been all about. But anyway, that's my opinion.
Yeah, and the Richard Prince case, which had to do with the Rastafarians holding guitars and having, blue smudge marks on them. But, that's Richard Prince, who's kind of in a league of his own.
Well, both Prince and Koons, admit that they make a lot of money when they do this because they get a lot of press. And this stuff sells for outrageous sums of money. They do it deliberately.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Copyright Forum today, Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood. And Bill, I got to say, it's going pretty well considering you guys are on the phone.
It's not bad.
It's a little difficult to coordinate at times, but you two seem like old professionals. You're certainly old anyway. All right, let's go. I think
you better be glad we're not there.
Tom in Great Barrington is finally there. Tom.
Hey, sorry about that. I drove through Stockbridge and lost you guys.
Okay, you're on.
Know what that's like.
Yeah, so I've got two music questions, and these are about a podcast that I'm doing. Haven't started it yet. And it's with my nephew, and we have this little thing we call Generation Gap, where I'm testing him on things when I grew up. And so I play like 5 seconds of Madonna's Vogue, and he got it. Can we use that?
I think it would be fair use to use 5 seconds as kind of a musical quiz game. You're using the music for a different purpose. You're trying to describe something about generations and the differences of generations. I think that's absolutely fair use. However, I think the automatic bots that may be, checking out your podcasts to look for infringement will not, these automatic bots that recognize melodies and blank out YouTube videos, Facebook videos, and perhaps your podcast are not going to see it that way. So you may have some struggle because of these automatic bots, but
in terms of the law, I think you're absolutely, from what you've described, I think you're absolutely in the right.
So here's the other thing that is happening on this podcast where, I'm not going to go into it, but anyway, one of us is going to be playing The Little Mermaid, Disney's Little Mermaid, on the piano and talking about that movie and how it's my nephew and how it really influenced him. And so we were just going to have a piano version of one of the songs playing in the background. No lyrics. Would that pass the box?
I think the same answer, because you are talking about the movie that the song came from and you're critiquing it. Again, though, the automatic computer bots aren't necessarily going to recognize your right to do that.
Interesting. Now, will the bots be able to just pick up the melody, or does it have to pick up the actual recording?
It will pick up the melody.
Interesting.
A few years ago, someone had a video taken off the air. It was a bird singing in his backyard that happened to be singing like a Fleetwood Mac song.
No way. Really?
Something like that. Yes.
That's crazy.
Yes.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot. That's weird, man. That's very weird.
Yeah.
Speaking of bots, Michael Moore, he has a movie out, and I think it got pulled from YouTube. I don't think it was the bots, but there was some question about 4 or 5 seconds of copyrighted material in the movie. Did you see that?
I saw that it was pulled. I saw that it was pulled down, and I didn't see the reason. But he had, and this was a big, these takedown notices and the use of them and what motivates them. There was a big article in the New York Times. It was either over the weekend or last week about these fan fiction writers who are writing about what was it called, the Omegaverse?
Yeah,
it was like. It's an intriguing article. It's these people that are writing all these short stories about this fictitious world of, I don't know, hypersexual wolfmen or something, and
right.
There's like all this,
that old trope.
Yeah. And it's this fairly big thing, and a whole bunch of people are all writing about the same fictitious universe, and they're all writing about similar things, none of which are particularly original, and they're all like, claiming that they're all ripping each other off where it turns, and so stuff gets taken down, and it's talking about how they're using the copyright law as an to take their competitors out of the game. And it's really strange and distressing, and it goes to the heart of, what is original and what is creative, and what can copyright law do about it? And how can these huge, Amazons and Googles, kind of moderate their content in a reasonable way? And I think the answer is they can't. They just simply can't.
Well, let's take a quick break again. Bill Westwood and Paul Rapper here. I need a cocktail. It's just about that time. I want to go back to this issue about YouTube and the bots and Facebook, and we'll do that. Then we'll hit the emails and back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Vox Pop on WAMC, Copyright Forum with Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. The email address is voxpopwamc.org. Before we get to a few emails, let's go back to this concept of bots. And I find this really hard to imagine, that technology is to the point where they can grab a melody and say, oh, yeah, you're violating. And the reason I thought of you the other day, Paul, was that, one of these trends, you see these strange social things that go on during this lockdown nationwide. And one of them is every singer-songwriter and anybody who has an acoustic guitar is doing little concerts. And a lot, and some are okay, and some of them not so much. But the point is, a lot of them are doing cover music.
Yeah,
are they opening themselves up?
I don't think so. I mean, the worst that's happening now, you know, is that your stuff will get muted or removed,
which is not a bad thing in some cases.
But the bots don't operate, or at least they're not being made to operate in real time. So if it's a live concert going on and the guy's, you know, taking requests, you know, or doing karaoke like my friend, I'll do a shout out to Ritz Carlton, whose Monday night karaoke sessions are just about the most wonderful thing that anybody's doing in this space.
Cool.
Anywhere in the world. You know, if you're just doing it live, you're going to be okay because nothing's being recorded. The stuff's being performed. There might be some songwriter issues, you know, but I'll leave it up to ASCAP and BMI to come up with a way to deal with it because and it hasn't stopped anyone from doing this. It's when they post the concerts for replay. That's where things might start getting muted.
Yeah.
Or removed. But in terms of the live shows, I'm not aware that anybody's been bothered at all, and that strikes me as a good thing.
I think some people have been bothered, but only by the quality. Bill Westwood is here. Paul Rapp is here. It's the copyright form. Some are very good, by the way.
Yes, they are.
Some not so much. This email came in from David in Kingston. I'm a visual artist and musician. I often share visual art, sometimes music videos on social media. I have not sold any creations through the platform, but I may wish to in the future. By posting digital examples of my work, am I placing my art at risk in terms of copyright protection?
Yes, if it's not registered, you certainly are.
All right.
I mean, if it's not registered, you know, but you know, the thing is when you post stuff on social media, you want people to share it, you know, you want it copied and you want it to go viral. And that's sharing. And that's, you know, off it goes. You're not giving up your copyright, you know, notwithstanding the Instagram thing we talked about before. But if you really want to protect your stuff, and it's your choice whether you want to protect it or not, you should register with the copyright office. You know, at some point, you know, preferably before you post it, but you know, if you want the thing to go viral and that's more important to you than protecting your copyright, you know, you register it if you think it's going to be big, you know, or, and I should mention that the copyright office, Bill, did you know this just raised their rates?
I bet they did.
Yep. Yeah. Significantly. Yeah, significantly.
Yeah. I didn't know until I was registering someone's book last week and suddenly this price came up and I'm like, whoa.
No, they went up significantly. I just as a visual artist myself, I stand by what I said a little while ago. While you might want something to go viral, if you're going to turn around and try to monetize it and sell it, and it's already out there everywhere for anybody who wants it to make a copy, then you're not going to be able to monetize it, at least not successfully. And not only that, but if someone takes it and starts using it somewhere in a way that you're not happy with, if that's not registered prior to their taking and using it, you have no protection. So the social media thing is a double-edged sword. You know, yes, you can get out there, get a piece of work, a new piece that you're happy about, and get it before, you know, tens of thousands of eyes and viewers. But there are a lot of people out there that'll take it and do things with it. And I deal with illustrators literally a couple of months who have this sort of thing happening to them, and they come to me and say, what can I do? And I say, well, you know, you're pretty much SOL.
Yeah, right. You know? Bill Westwood is here. Paul Rapp is here. And we have a ton of calls here. So let's see if we can blast through a few. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Simon in Charlton. Simon, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
So I bought a rubber stamp at a big chain store, and it has a very nice picture of a mouse engraved in the rubber. And then on the side, it says copyright and the name of a big corporation, and it says all rights reserved. Well, okay, what does that mean in the context of a rubber stamp that I purchased with the idea that I can, I mean, does that mean I'm not allowed to put it on some paper and make a copy of that mouse?
No, no, you can do that. You can, that's the purpose that it's created for. But what you can't do is turn around and make a copy of that illustration of the mouse or whatever it is and put it on a poster and start selling it or doing something else with it or make another rubber stamp and start selling it with something like that on it.
Yeah.
So I can stamp it onto a piece of paper, but then I can't sell that piece of paper?
Well, Paul can answer that better than I. I think that becomes a bit of a gray area. But look, it's sort of like if you purchase a book that's copyrighted and you want to turn around and sell that book to someone else, you have a perfect right to do that. You can use that physical book any way you want to use it, but you can't copy material out of that book and turn around and sell that.
Hmm. Right, so I can sell the rubber stamp.
Yeah, good luck.
Right.
Whether you can sell, you can stamp a piece of paper and sell that piece of paper, I don't know. I mean, you can't make new rubber stamps and sell those. You can't make the stamp and then, you know, copy that and sell posters and postcards of the image from the rubber stamp. So probably technically, you know, you can stamp anything you want, but can you sell the things you stamp? I think technically probably not. I think practically, who's going to stop you?
Simon, great call. Thank you very much. Andrew and Mayfield.
That was great.
Andrew, go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, I've got a question about historical work. Can you hear me?
Yeah, a little bit. You're on speakerphone, so we'll do the best we can.
I have a question about historical works. Can you talk a little bit about when a poem enters into the public domain, how that process works?
Yes, at this point, anything that was originally published before 1924 is going to be in the public domain. If the stuff was not published, it's going to be, what is it, Bill? 70 years after the death of the author, I believe, is the rule now. I have a client who purchased a whole bunch of photographs of thoroughbred horses that were taken between 17 and 1930, and her question was, can she republish these? And these were snapshots. These didn't appear to have ever been published, and meaning, you know, in a magazine or in a book.
Right.
These were just snapshots in someone's collection, and there was no indication who the photographer was. And so we're in. I'm like, you know, my advice was it might be infringing someone's rights, but they're certainly not around anymore. And their heirs, you know, if these were snapshots in a box with no name on it, no one seems to have cared up till now about copyright ownership. You know, I think, you know, you go ahead and if someone comes, you know, it's a classic what's called orphan works.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and I'm always in the air, and you know, I err in the direction of getting stuff out so the public can enjoy it rather than keep it locked up under lock and key under, you know, some fear that someone's going to pop out of nowhere and claim infringement. I mean, the likelihood that somebody's going to claim infringement from a 1920 picture of a horse, a photograph, is pretty slight.
Bill Westwood, do you agree?
I'm sorry?
Do you agree, Bill?
Yes, I do agree with that. I think that both the age of those and, as Paul said, sort of the anonymity of the photographer would definitely have these qualifying as what did you just say, Paul? Orphan works. I'm sorry.
I think we all need a little happy nappy at the end of the show here.
Oh, tell me about it.
Oh, man. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Ann in Cohoes. Ann, you're up.
Okay, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm an artist, and I design jewelry and resell and all that. Basically, I came up with the idea to use old Chanel buttons off of jackets and make earrings out of them. And I tried doing this on a couple of sites, like selling sites like Poshmark and what other one? It doesn't really matter what other one. But anyway, and then I met up with some resistance from, they said it violated the TOS terms of service because what I'm doing is I'm reworking a button and making it into something else and using their trademark. And I wanted to know, If I don't choose to do it on there because it violates Posh or whatever, could I still do this on my own and not get sued? And Chanel has sued a couple of people that were doing this, but mostly they're going after people that are making fake Chanel. Wow. And that's it.
All right.
Well, Chanel might be a little bit like, Disney in terms of protecting those things. Paul, what do you think? I would be a little... Given the fact they've got a history of going after people, I would be a little reticent.
Yeah, I think they're over aggressive, and you're using pieces of Chanel, actual pieces of Chanel jewelry to make new jewelry.
No, I'm using old buttons off of jackets, and I'm making earrings out of them. And the jacket is owned by me, like it's mine. And so they have that thing, the first sale doctrine. So once I purchase it, I can do what I want with the item. I'm not doing this on a large scale. So what I would do is then I would purchase again. But it's on a very small scale that I'm doing this.
Yeah. I mean, the first...
Well, maybe under those circumstances. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're safe with the first sale doctrine as a matter of copyright law. But a matter of trademark law, if somebody looks at your... At your jewelry and thinks that it might have come from Chanel, then that's going to be a trademark issue. So I think you want to be careful that you don't design something that someone, someone looking at it reasonably is going to go, oh, look, that's a Chanel product, rather than a postmodern thing of yours.
I think who's would be misled is the public. You see, the buyer knows that these are old buttons,
right?
And they're real buttons. And what I've done is I've gone and made earrings out of them. So instead of people paying $1,000 for, or paying $500 since they're used buttons, they would be, instead of paying $500, they're paying like, let's say $120 with me.
Hmm.
I got a lot of buzz when I did this online. And then the site took me down that I was selling on. They basically removed them. And I'm a starving artist, basically.
I think your argument is certainly valid and persuasive. However, the reason I mentioned Disney before is they don't care about such things, and maybe Chanel is in the same boat. You know, whether they can win a case against you or not doesn't mean they wouldn't file a case against you. And you're not going to be able to afford to defend yourself because it's expensive. That would be my concern. The first sale doctrine, you're absolutely right. In theory, you could, take a handful of those buttons and go out and sell them. I don't know why, on one hand, it wouldn't apply if you were doing this as part of jewelry. But that said, some of these companies don't care. So I think you would have to proceed with caution at the very least.
All right, we only have about a minute and a half here, but let's go over to John in Lake George. John, you're on. Hello? Oh, you got your radio on. Now you have lost out on the final moment. Dino in Newburgh. Dino, you're up.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have a quick question. I plan on starting a YouTube channel to document the build of a tiny home, which is going to be christened Better Things. I have been curious about using the first 8 seconds of the actual song Better Things by the Kinks, and was wondering if that would be okay as fair use, or should I have it re-recorded by musician friends, and can I use that?
Probably neither. I think you probably want to find somebody local and do an original song. Re-recording it is still, you're still going to be infringing on Ray Davis's songwriting,
right,
as opposed to the Kinks recording, and using it as an intro to a YouTube show is not transformational. I mean, it's how Ray Davies and the Kinks make money, is licensing songs for reasons exactly like that. So I don't think you're going to get by with a fair use on that. You know, you can try, but, you know, don't be surprised if it gets taken down.
Well, that is where we were going to have to leave it here, gentlemen. That was a good cracking hour of radio fun. Bill Westwood and Paul Rapp, guys, thanks for being here over the phone. Hopefully next time, this whole opening up of society once again will let you sit in the studio and you can kibitz all you want. But for now, we'll do it over the phone. Support comes from George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services, and deliveries. GeorgePropane.com. And the Center for Disability Services, thanking their staff who are working to help people with their life skills during the crisis. CFDSNY.com/careers for information about helping others. And Kent Hicks Construction Company, featuring East Branch Homes, a new division of hybrid prefab homes that are net zero ready and low in embodied carbon, traditional to modern styles available. EastBranchHomes.com. Once again, thanks to Bill Westwood and Paul Rapp for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Sorry if we did not get to your call. We'll do it again soon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Charlene Knight. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Home Improvement with Darren Tracy. That's 2 p.m. tomorrow. Stand by now for The Book Show.